Well, now you just used a really big word there that I'd like to define: budget. Okay. You need a margin of safety. So whatever your budget is, margin of safety. And we bought right. That was our margin of safety. And again, I want to quote somebody super famous, Warren Buffett. He wasn't really the one who came up with the idea of margin of safety in finance. That would be really more his mentor, Benjamin Graham. But he's probably made it more famous than anyone else. And you got to realize, going into any transaction, particularly real estate, there are going to be things that you literally could not know. And I could go on and on about what was wrong about that place and things that even we knew this guy ran it like a slumlord, and we had no idea, what it would actually look like when we open up the walls.
Have you ever asked yourself what can go wrong when investing in apartments? What challenges do investors face when dealing with such a large asset class? Well, on the No BS Apartment Investing Podcast, we place expert professionals on the hot seat, ask them the tough questions that may be running through your mind, all while removing the fluff that comes with apartment investing. We aim to put your mind at ease while showing you that investing in apartments is the way to financial freedom. And now for your host, Mark Caesar.
Welcome, everyone. On this episode, we are talking with Mr. George Roberts, who is a bioscientist as well as a property management owner. He owns a construction company that actually reached seven figures in 2021 in the midst of a pandemic. So today you will learn George's story, and you will also learn how he's managed to, from as a bioscientist, he's managed to be part of a 34 unit on a general partnership side, as well as invest in 468 multifamily units in the multifamily space as a passive investor. George, welcome, sir.
Well, thank you for that outstanding introduction, Mark. It's great to be here.
I appreciate it. So let's jump right into it. Give us a little bit of background about you. George, the bioscientist.
Right. So let's start there. Let's see. It goes back to the early 2000s, completed a PhD in bioscience. The laboratory was focused on chlamydia and yeast. So the yeast they were focused on were the more ordinary yeast, the ones that are used in beer and bread. Really exciting, lifelong dream of mine to work in bioscience, and was really exciting to be able to complete that dream and to go on and do a couple of postdocs and do some very heavily cited work.
Very nice. Now I, as a bioscientist, I know that takes a lot of schooling, a lot of gruesome hours and so forth. Like, can you detail how the passion behind that and how did that turn out for you? Because I'm not a big fan of spending too much time in school.
Yeah. So in college, I just found myself at the top of the class in my science courses and felt a real calling. It is wonderful. It's an exciting career. You're absolutely right about the hours. It's long, long hours and probably minimum wage by the time you finish working all those hours for what you get. So I remember when I was in graduate school, I got paid like less than $20,000 to teach some classes and to do all the research. And when I got to be a postdoc, I got to double that. So you could imagine for all those hours, that really wasn't a whole lot of dough, but it was a great and exciting career.
Yeah, that sounds very fun. Kudos to you on achieving what you've always wanted to do. So let's fast forward a bit. You're in real estate. You're the founder of Walnut Groves, which is an upscale residential construction company in Troy, Michigan. How did the shift from bioscientist, the long life dream, into real estate transpire?
Yeah, so I was a landlord even before that, but didn't really take it seriously, didn't take it like a business, really busy in the lab, and it was hard to really focus on that. So I did the whole mom and pop thing, didn't raise the rent, but didn't get a whole lot of calls on the telephone. And so it felt like a decent success. My sister, she was the one who came to me with the idea that, hey, you know, let's build homes. I helped her found that company, but really don't have a big day-to-day role, because what I wanted to do was go and, you know, I realized, hey, wait, entrepreneurship is awesome, right? It totally lit my fire. And I got the taste for that at the construction company. I decided, well, hey, let me pivot into something that can be all my own. And that was value add real estate. I figured, hey, I already understand what it means to be a landlord. If I just professionalize things and go for the economies of scale, boom, I've got something.
Very nice. So with that said, you started the construction company was also part of the management company, I presume?
So that's residential construction, totally separate from anything else that I'm doing. Yeah, so that's in Troy, Michigan, where I grew up, but not located anywhere near my multifamily investments, which, of course, we went for the Sun Belt, like most people who are looking to use the syndication model. It's great to have a place where those populations and the jobs growth is likely to push the rents in the direction you're going to need to go.
Awesome. I appreciate that. So you also are the principal at Horizon Multifamily. And as you alluded to, you focus on the value add, that have value add play along the Southeast corridor. What about multifamily and the value add caught your attention that said, okay, this is my golden goose that I want to pursue?
Well, I figured it's going to have to be real estate because that's what I already know. And yeah, I just listen to all the gurus. A lot of them say, oh yeah, don't do multifamily. That's advanced. And they're right. I mean, it is advanced. But what they don't mention to you is that, you know, they've probably been running their own show for a long time and they do everything themselves. And so it does seem like a big jump to them. But if you shift your mindset and you say, hey, multifamily is a team sport, I'm going to build that team. Now, all of a sudden, it's not so frightening.
Awesome. So did you go into multifamily as with the mindset that, hey, I want to be a GP, or did you test the waters with the LP side? Because we know that today we hear a lot of speculation where you should start as an LP first to get the scope of the business opposed to starting a GP. Like, what was your take on that?
So I'm a big fan of parallel tracks. There's no reason not to be an LP unless you need to conserve all your capital. If you got to conserve all your capital because you've really got only enough to hopefully be part of one active deal, I totally get it. But I would say pursue both. As you're learning to become an active investor, go and test the waters with being an LP. But I don't think you absolutely need to start there.
Okay, well answered. I appreciate that. Now, what is your burning why that wakes you up in the morning and says, hey, I want to do real estate. Like, I'm very passionate about it. What is that drive for you?
Well, I would say first in general, it's just creating a legacy for my family and for my community. But, and again, in general, entrepreneurship, it's just an amazing tribe. I get to meet great people like Mark Caesar, right? And when I come and I go to your meetup in the evening and I get to hear from people like Jeff Holst, right? I'm talking about, you are not going to meet people like this regularly anywhere else in the world. So being able to meet people and being able to develop myself, I mean, even as a bioscientist, I develop myself very narrowly and very deeply, but it's nothing like the entrepreneurial world, where I get to feel like anything I do to develop myself, it impacts, whether it's doing something like Toastmasters or my podcast, where I get to become better at speaking to an audience, or whether it's leadership, understanding finance. Entrepreneurship is just amazing. It has been the greatest personal journey of my life.
Awesome. I appreciate you sharing that. Now, as we all know, we like to hear a journey that our speakers experience in their multifamily or real estate endeavors that they did not perceive or plan for. Can you share with us like one or two scary stories that through your entire plan, out of sync, and how did you manage to overcome that situation, and how did it help you become a better and savvier investor?
Yeah, great. Well, I'll just start with my favorite quote about planning. You've probably heard it. Mike Tyson, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face, right? And that's what happens in the rough and tumble of business. So I'll describe my first apartment deal. Great deal. Got in the pandemic. So to take two steps back, how did we get into it? Well, the seller had two deals fall through because people are not really sure how do you value things in the pandemic. Is everybody to leave? Or maybe they're forced to kind of stay because nobody has mobility. So after they walked, it was really easy for us. We decided to put in a lowball offer. We put it in a fair bit below what we were told would even be taken seriously. Well, lo and behold, he was ready to deal. So we got in at a super great price. And then as soon as we got into the deal, we realized things were much worse than we had imagined. And it's funny because some of the things were obvious. I mean, this was advertised as a new roof, but you can look at the pictures that were included. That show it was plainly not a new roof. So, in retrospect, maybe it should have been obvious that there would be other things as well. Well, this is Central Florida. And I'll tell you, if you're not familiar with the area, you have rainstorms tear through every day at about 2 p.m. In the summer and through much of the rest of the season as well. But a lot of people tell you when you inspect a property, make sure you inspect it during a rainstorm if you have the opportunity, right? Make sure that you're there. Well, guess what? We saw, they're always telling you, oh, hey, come this way, not that way. Well, there was a tenant who had his door open and, you can hear him kind of griping. Well, guess what? We went into the other door and found out that his ceiling was leaking through and he was self-evicting through the process. So, yeah, that was our little Niagara Falls experience. And so after that, there were a couple other places that were damaged, a couple tenants just literally self-evicting. And, did we get a discount? No, because he was literally not willing to deal with us, literally not willing to. That's an opportunity. Some people call it retrading, but I think when there are material misrepresentations, that is not a retrade. But we decided, look, we got the best deal we could possibly get. Lowest transaction value of the year in Orlando. So we decided, hey, we're going to hold. We're going to do this. And I think it was a good choice. But again, enough bragging. So let's get into the real stuff. So yeah, we got rats and cockroaches. And if you're from the north, you'd be surprised how many pests you get down south. One of the great things about cold weather is that it kills everything in the winter and they got to start over. So we got no house flies at least half the year where I live in Michigan. But yeah, coming down to Florida, a lot of things grow. Everything grows. Yeah. So it was a pretty big mess. We saw there was an electrical fire in one place, but it wasn't until we got to the very, very end of our reposition, we found out that there was a lady, didn't have an electrical fire yet, but all her outlets had gone out but one. And she was using one of those giant power strips that people use for their computers to run the entire unit. So happy to say we got there before something bad happened. But that was obviously the next electrical fire waiting to happen. So let's see, what else went wrong? Well, because you have these enormous rainstorms tearing through literally every day, sometimes two a day, it took a long time to get that roof properly fixed. And when we did, after months and months of waiting, guess what? Another one tears through that was not expected. So you need usually at least 3 days in a row of dry weather. So they barely got up there in time to put the tarps up and had some damage on the other side of the building, but this time at least, thankfully, not Niagara Falls, just a little water stains up there.
Wow, that is that's a whole lot of package there. But how did you guys, manage to overcome those obstacles? Where with the roof, with the outlets, outage and so forth, did you guys budget that into your CapEx or was that something that you didn't plan for and you had to scramble and work it out.
Well, now you just used a really big word there that I'd like to define: budgets. Okay. You need a margin of safety. So whatever your budget is, margin of safety. And we bought right. That was our margin of safety. And again, I want to quote somebody super famous, Warren Buffett. He wasn't really the one who came up with the idea of margin of safety in finance. That would be really more his mentor, Benjamin Graham. But he's probably made it more famous than anyone else. And you got to realize, going into any transaction, particularly real estate, there are going to be things that you literally could not know. And I could go on and on about what was wrong about that place and things that even we knew this guy ran it like a slumlord, and we had no idea what it would actually look like when we open up the walls. There's another thing. You open up the walls, you're doing a heavier reposition.
Yep.
It's different than construction. And ground up construction, you got a lot of things you got to look out for, right? Like lumber prices. That's what hit us in 2021. But you have a completely different game that you're playing when you are doing a reposition, because you can have an expected by the very best. You can have all the construction knowledge walking in, but when you open up those walls, you never know what you're going to find. Just one quick example, we found wires of different gauges that were wire nutted together. So that's another, wow. That's asking for a fire. So after we saw that, we ended up, well, maybe we're not just going to tear out all the wiring on the Niagara Falls side of the building. We're going to do that on the other side as well. And we're glad with that decision, because again, that lady that had the giant power strip was on the other side. So now we feel good about it. And again, no, did we budget for that? No. But when you buy rights, that's the first thing that protects you. The second thing that protected us is that this is a joint venture. So being that it's a joint venture, it's not like you have to go back to 15, 30 or 100 investors and say, hey, this is not a 3 to 5 year hold. This is going to have to be essentially an infinite hold. We're going to have to turn this into a cash flow play versus that we're going to get you out in 5 years. So that also made it easier. Certainly, I think we could have made the deal work either way and probably would have hit our numbers. But again, joint ventures are easier in the sense that usually you're working with people who have the net worth. They have not only more sophistication, but they're intimately involved, right? I mean, there's nothing to explain. We're all part of this. Right. We know, and I'm calling it an infinite hold. My partners are not necessarily down with that yet. But again, we're looking at this as a much larger thing. And then the other thing is it's all about your due diligence, right? There's the due diligence of the deal. There's the due diligence of the area. And we could see, and part of why we pivoted is that we do see the gentrification of the area. Everybody around us has successfully repositioned the apartments. This was smaller, and that's why it was left. This was like a tiny little pearl in the oyster, and the big fish just weren't going to go for it. So it was a great first deal. We got a lot of good things going on. There's the Virgin Express is coming through, and that's going to connect central Orlando to southern Orlando, all the way down to Miami. And we also have a great road expansion project that's going to link this to the Mall at Millenia. Anybody who's been to Orlando has probably been to the Mall at Millenia. And the roads were just kind of weird, I have to say, that you had to sort of wangle around to get out to that mall. But now it's going to be connected to what I call sort of the nicer side of town. And you got all these things going for us. So again, it was that pivot was something we were able to do because we're continuously doing the market research. And we see this really makes sense. And we've been vindicated. Our first unit went for more than double the original rent. Nice. So everything from below market rents. Because, I mean, it's not like there's nothing good about the slumlord. I mean, they were just seriously below market, hadn't been raised for quite some time. When you see everybody on month-to-month leases, that's another sign that you're dealing with either a mom and pop or slumlord situation. But again, that impacts the underwriting, right? Because when you see, hey, I don't have to wait, you know, 2 months to kick out, you know, 10% of the tenants and 6 months to kick out half of the tenants, boom. We could go as quick as we wanted. And so that was a great thing knowing going into it.
Wow. That's actually amazing. I just want to backtrack a bit. You mentioned a few items that you look at when looking at a property. What are, can you elaborate more on the metrics that you and your team typically look at when assessing an asset and deciding that, hey, okay, this is what we want to buy?
Sure. There are a lot of things. I think you have to start at the very beginning. I mean, you're going to look at things like, what's your break-even ratio? Like, how many units need to be occupied that we can cash flow this thing? Another thing that's kind of obvious or should be obvious, your debt service coverage ratio. Some people say like 1.2, 1.25, if you want to get financing, it better be at least that good. Some people I see push that up to 1.6. What I would say is that no deal has everything. So when you look at the deal, if everything is good or pretty good, and you can have a few things that are really good, then that's a decent deal. You don't want to have anything out of place, and there better be some things about the deal that you're able to make really work. So let's see, what else did we cover? How about the cash on cash? This is important for any deal, but if you're going to syndicate, it's very important. Because I don't see people coming into these deals without a decent preferred return. So you want to make sure the cash on cash works, particularly if it's a syndication. And then again, and I'm talking mainly in terms of the syndication metrics rather than the actual underwriting, which we can kind of go back to. But that internal rate of return, for a long time, people have been saying, hey, we know we're conservative because we're not counting on a refinance. Well, if you've been paying attention to what's going on with inflation, those refinances may be absolutely impossible. So we may go from a time frame where it's conservative underwriting to not count on the refinance to where you can't count on it at all, and you better find something else if you want to call yourself conservative. So again, I want to say underwriting is something, it's always a moving target, and that's a good thing, because if it was easy, everybody would have found their way into real estate by now.
Have you ever lost 25 to 50 grand in educational programs designed to teach you how to become a real estate investor or to create generational wealth and passive income? The GOB Network, founded by Jim Biggs, helps new, aspiring, or seasoned investors find and close deals without having to dish out thousands of dollars to coaching programs. The best teacher in life is experience, and the best advice Jim has ever received in his lifetime was advice that's never paid for. So if you're looking to get into your first or next deal and need the key pieces to get it done, check out GOBnetwork.com and sign up for a free account to gain access to a community that will help you get deals done. That's GOBnetwork.com. Add mcaesar50 at gmail.com as your sponsor.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Now, what is success to you? Everyone has their own definition of it. So can you elaborate more on what is your secret, quote unquote, to success?
Right. Well, first of all, the definition I would say is personal growth. Anything that truly allows me to grow as a person, that is a big victory. My favorite days are the hard ones. And I like to practice stoicism. If you go back to, and I'm not sure if I can quote the original author, but what you want to say was Epictetus. He said, you know, when you have one of those days, you know, where you get thrown off that rhythm, what you want to do is say, it was for this I was in training. This is what I prepared for. So I actually love those hard days, the days where I'm on the phone all day, when things are going sideways, when I have to just jump to the helm to right the ship. Those are the best days. Those are the days of personal growth. A day like that is worth 10 days. When you're in calm seas.
Awesome. And what is the biggest surprise that you found in your success? What happened? What is there something that happened that you did not predict or expect?
I don't know. I think I'll take public speaking. I had a very long path to becoming a public speaker. As a scientist, I was always presenting, but never felt comfortable. I became a Toastmaster. That helped, but I still felt it was like Winston Churchill. One of the greatest orators of all time, but he memorized his speeches. So I felt like, well, I'm still not there. But podcasting, going on to the people's podcasts, getting up at the various meetups, including my own, When I took it to a field where I was truly passionate about, when I wasn't just going to Toastmasters and talking about finance or Warren Buffett, that's when things became real. So something unexpected is just the value of having the opportunity to become a true public speaker.
Powerful. Is there a failure or a big failure that you've learned from over the course of your journey, whether it be on the W-2 side or real estate?
So in terms of failures, a lot of it is just not starting soon enough. Anything that I could mention, not starting soon enough was a big failure, not getting a VA soon enough, not being willing to do what every leader says, hey, I'm the only person who can do this task. And realizing, no, you're not. If you're a true leader is somebody just reading The Pumpkin Plan last couple of days, great book. True leader is somebody who they find the problem, they define the solution, and they put systems in place so that other people can solve the problem. So realizing what it truly means to be an entrepreneur, I would define it as entrepreneurship is leadership, but it's very different than corporate leadership because you have, although you're a decision maker, you have a much greater appetite for risk. But the vision component is also different. The vision component is primary, whereas, you know, as a lower level or even middle level management position, you don't really need to have quite as much of the vision. It can be more about, tactics, et cetera, strategy and tactics.
Perfect. Speaking of entrepreneurship, you are the host of The Foundry, where leaders are forced daily, an amazing podcast. I had the chance to listen to a few episodes. Like, what brought that podcast about?
Well, it was the realization, again, that entrepreneurship is a different type of leadership, realizing that entrepreneurship is one of the greatest proven grounds for talent. When you have people like Henry Ford, didn't start tinkering on his side until he was 37, didn't found Ford Motor Company until he was 40. You have people like Steve Jobs that truly didn't find their way in the world, didn't find their place until they started executing on their own vision. So another person that I'm really inspired by would be Mr. Personality, Kevin O'Leary. And he points out that people who are bad employees are often great entrepreneurs, vice versa. You might be a great entrepreneur and you might be struggling someplace. You might feel like, hey, I'm not a great employee, but maybe you're like Kevin O'Leary and you just don't want to be ordered to get down on your knees and scrape the gum off of the tile floor. Maybe that's not for you. And there is a place in the world for people that don't like to be told what to do. It's not an easy place or a comfortable place, but it can be a very exciting ride. And that's entrepreneurship. So for me, entrepreneurship lights my fire. I don't want to be a manager in a corporate situation where being a better manager means finding more things that can go wrong and putting more process in place to make sure that things go run down the narrow channel. I want to look for revenue. I want to drive new lines of business. I'm looking more on the positive side than in preventing bad things from happening. So whereas I felt like in the W-2 world, which I love and hope that I keep my W-2 for a long time because it's great to have multiple streams of income, but I realized that really couldn't be the place where I developed myself to the fullest, that I had to be an entrepreneur.
Wow. Now, you just said something that is very interesting, and I think it's a very age-old debate that we have now where you'd like to keep your W-2 as long as you can because you want to have multiple streams of income. But we typically hear a lot of people in the entrepreneurial world, especially in real estate, who says, hey, quit your job, focus on real estate. What is your take on that mindset?
Well, I'll start with the first YouTube channel that I found that really changed my world, Phil Pustiovsky. He talks about how he was living in his pickup truck, eating baked beans, and he had too much pride to drive from Tennessee to Texas to see his parents. He decided he was going to make it happen, and he did, and he became extraordinarily successful. But that was pain. That was pain. He quit his job right away. I know a lot of people who do. They just quit their job right away, and they make it work. But you know what? That's a very painful path to go on. And one of the things I like the most about multifamily real estate, whether you're doing it passively or actively or some combination of the two, you can get much closer to passivity with this than you can with anything else. The economies of scale, having all your units in one place, having a team, you can really scale. Like people talk about, you know, sometimes you get a downshift your career. Maybe you have, a child and you want to focus on your child, and that's the appropriate thing to do. And that's beautiful. Well, guess what? If you're in multifamily, you can just decide to take a smaller percentage of the deal and get more great partners, and you can do those things you need to do.
Wow, I like that. So you heard it first here, everyone. Don't be so quick to quit your job. Make sure to just learn how to leverage that position until you can make a decision where if you do want to quit your job and you're successful at real estate, then you can pivot full time. Thanks for sharing that tidbit, George. I know it's a debate that I hear constantly, and it's never ending. So it's like a real bottomless pit with this debate. So I appreciate your take on it. Now, do you have a position within your company that you dislike the most, or that you just wish you didn't have to do on your own?
Wow, that's interesting, because when I came in, I thought that automating the website was fun. That was cool. It's like, great, we're getting ready for this torrent of investors. And I did enjoy it. But you know what? I'm still manually making my Zoom meetings. I didn't get the zap for that. So, once I merged over into focusing on things like, hey, I'm going to make our loss leader. I'm writing the ebook. I'm going to do the investor relations. Now, all of a sudden, a lot of those things just don't excite me much anymore. So it's, capacity is limited. I've reached my bandwidth. So those things, I'm glad that I got somebody, my partner, Pav Prokop. He is amazing with that sort of stuff, and he really enjoys it. So again, you got to find a great team.
I agree. Now, do you have any best time-saving hacks that you found helps you out with your day-to-day?
Yeah, I think more than anything, passion. I'm going to say when you really want something, you don't waste time. So I have all kinds of hacks. If I was doing this in my office, I'd be able to pick up. I set up my environment for productivity. So I've got my Jim Rohn quotes on the desk. If I find myself staring off into space, then that's a place that I can go and get re-energized. I've got Grant Cardone's top 10 tips, things like that. All around me, you want to set up your workspace for productivity. I've got maps all over the wall of Orlando. Because if you're out of state, which if you're in multifamily, you're almost certainly out of state, you need to know that market. And if it's not someplace that you're driving through every day to work, live, and play, definitely I would say put those maps up on the wall, know your neighborhoods. And when you walk by, if I'm lifting weights or I'm just passing into the other room, take another look at that. And you got to just burn that into your brain. So I would say, you got to feel the passion. If you're not feeling a passion, if you're wasting time, sure, you can use time management tips and you can plan out your day, and all of that is good. But I would say just take one step deeper. Our emotions, they're there for a reason. And people think that they're kind of useless or superfluous and we should just be logical, but they're there for a reason. If you're bored, you're not feeling your passion, you got to find that again, or else you're always going to be going back to the time management tips. It's never going to feel like first nature.
Love it. And in regards to the maps, the map that you mentioned scenario, I actually seen one of my mentors. He had that in his office one time, and I asked him, like, why do you have a map of Albany, New York? And he elaborated. I thought it was crazy at first, but he definitely elaborated the same sentiment that you share, which is know your areas. You see it every day, and you can just pretty much, pinpoint the exact areas where you're buying and what makes sense. So that definitely is an amazing trick. And I also have a map of North Carolina in my office where I definitely just look at it and say, okay, avoid these areas. These are the areas I want to focus in. And it just gives you that passion to understand the market and know it in more detail. So that is a great tip. Now, what top three tips would you share with a newbie who's looking to get into the space, or an aspiring investor who is considering investing, becoming an investor? What are your top three tips that you would share with them?
Okay, so number one is going to be, do your homework. A lot of people will say, get a deal. But you know what? That's because they're successful and they didn't get washed out. All those people who got a crappy deal the first time around, it's five times as harder to get back off the mat. So do your homework. Don't feel like you're wasting time. If all you do today is listen to 3 hours of YouTube videos or five podcasts, as long as you're learning, that's a great first step. So make sure that that first deal is awesome. Then I'd also say focus on networking. There's no business I've ever seen where networking is literally so important. So many layers to the transaction. You got brokers, property managers, you've got all of the trades. These are all people who could possibly bring you a deal. So know those people. You're going to want to know other people who are owning and operating buildings like you. Maybe they can bring you a deal. Maybe they can help you take a deal down. So make sure that you're constantly networking and cast a wide net. I go to single family meetings too, because you'll find people, they may be a distressed landlord. And you talk about being a passive investor, and that makes sense. All of a sudden, wow, you know what? I could possibly be doing as well, giving my money to an experienced operator. And you're also going to find people who haven't really started yet. You can talk to them and say, why don't you start in multifamily? You know, you're a bright guy. You've done well in your career. So why don't you just start here? You know, cut the nonsense, because I'll take you to meet people who've been in this 5-10 years. And they say, oh, yeah, I waited until year 4 or year 6 to get into multifamily. And I'm still selling my single family homes. So I guess tip two would be networking. Cast a wide net. There are a lot of people that can help you, a lot of people you can help, and look where you can add that value. And the third thing is, you've got to differentiate yourself. And that is difficult. So for me, I differentiate myself largely through networking. I've got all kinds of things going. Got weekly networking online. I've got an evening networking that's a little bit more like yours. I'm going to start to invite speakers. Just had our first session. I've got the YouTube videos. And I'm always getting out there through every social media channel. That's what I'm trying to do to differentiate myself. If people learn it from you first, then you're the one they're going to trust. You're the one that they're going to want to do the deal with.
I love it. I love tip 2 and 3. I've actually implemented that into my day to day. I think since the pandemic has started, where we all have, you know, lived in on Zoom and we've all attended the same amount of networking events, but a lot of people were starting to connect with the same people. But I decided to actually cast a wider net and just, you know, branch out into different, you know, meetings where it's like, all right, if it's just a stocks or financial meeting, or as you mentioned, single family meeting, you're meeting a different perspective of people who may not necessarily know about multifamily or may not have thought about it. And you're coming in as that authority figure where, okay, I have the knowledge. This is what I bring to the table, and enticing them. So that is a powerful tip. I appreciate you sharing that, George. Now, we're coming down to the wire. What is next up for George and Horizon Multifamily, as well as Walnut Grove Home?
So for Horizon Multifamily, the next big thing is about building the name. So it's more like tip 3, writing the ebook. When I wrote Our Loss Leader, it was like 30 pages long. So I'm expanding that into a full-length book. Writing is something I do well. After writing a dissertation, after writing scientific articles, for some reason, writing for a general audience doesn't seem so scary at all. So again, it's all about getting the name out there, and it's about leveraging people. So I got a business coach, Charity Brown. She's helping me do some great things. And I've got a VA. It's all about passing off more tasks, or maybe getting a second VA. So again, it's all about taking the founder experience, where you're like the chief everything officer, and becoming a true leader. So that's where I'd say I'm with Horizon Multifamily. As for Walnut Grove Homes, it's all about the financing. So we're getting more and more professional. Now we've sold three homes. They were all, I don't want to talk too much about the pricing, but let's just say that they were well above $500,000 a piece. So that was great. Things are just headed in the right direction for us in terms of home prices. Just about any market you're in is going up. So we're going to start to build things faster. You know, it's pretty amazing how long it takes and how expensive. I mean, just laying down the streets and getting all of the utilities in there. Wow. Talk about a cost sink and getting the business to the point where it's no longer an alligator. We've got the working capital. Well, the next thing is that we're going to start rolling forward. We've got some decent working capital. Don't need to add capital to business anymore. And just building those homes a lot faster.
Awesome. Now, you do host a meetup as well on Wednesdays. Can you share a little bit about the meetup and what it entails?
Yeah, it's at noon Eastern. And what I like to do is just network. I like these pure networking meetups because it's a great way to meet 12 or 24 or 50 people. So I do I like to do noontime, Eastern time. A lot of people I know, they're either in Orlando or someplace in Florida or in Michigan, someplace in between. So I chose noon Eastern. So the other thing is that, yeah, I also like to have a meetup where people get to learn some more. So that would be like my in-person meetup in Michigan, or I'm going to start doing the first week of the month. I can only do this once a month. I'm not like you, Mark. I'm not going to be able to do this every week. But once a month, I would like to have a meetup where there's a speaker and you can come in and learn about somebody in depth. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To our listeners, I am a member of George's meetup at 12 on Wednesdays. And right after this, we're actually jumping on his meetup. So that is pretty fun. So we will definitely be dropping the links and the show and all the references and resources George mentioned throughout the episode in the show notes. So I hope to see all of you guys there. Now, one more question for you, George. If you had to start over with the knowledge that you have now, what would you have done differently then?
Yeah, the couple of things that I mentioned, I will just underscore, is network more earlier, go to conferences earlier. Of course, COVID kind of threw a monkey wrench in that. And then passing off tasks earlier, automating more earlier, not being afraid to spend a little bit on the business. And that's the great thing about having the first deal. Once you have that first deal, it's like, you know that this is productive, right? And those small expenses you had, they'll all look really, really small. So not being afraid to spend a little bit and getting that virtual assistant, very valuable. Should have done that sooner. But again, getting the right one was very important, and I'm very happy with my choice. So again, you want to make these decisions earlier and faster, but again, make sure you're making the right choice, because a hire is a very fateful decision. You hire the wrong person and it's hard to get rid of them. It's a little easier when it's contract work than when they're actually signed on as like a full W-2. But again, yeah, it's very important to pick the right people.
Awesome. Great tips. So we've come to an end. George, I want to thank you so much for surviving our hot seat and sharing your amazing story with us and with our audience. Again, listeners, all the contact info for George will be posted in the show notes. And with that said, happy investing to everyone and to your success. Thank you again, George.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for tuning in. And I hope you've gotten massive value from this episode. But before you leave, subscribe, download, and leave us your 5-star review, as we want to continue pumping you with massive value and content on the No BS Apartment Investing Podcast. Until next time.